Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening, my friends. Good evening once again. Welcome to Progressive News Network. I'm your host, Rick Spizak, and on behalf of myself and my co-producer, Mickey Royce, I want to welcome you to a wonderful show. And just like Cisco and Woody said just a minute ago, this is a union world, and it's a union world we're fighting for. There's a better world coming. And as a matter of fact, we have pretty much a union show tonight. We've got Alphonse Mayfield, president of Florida SEIU. We've got Arlene Holt-Baker, executive vice president of the National AFL-CIO. And from the Union Jack, we've got Dennis Campbell, author and publisher of the UK Progressive. Well, welcome once again. And we've got some great news items for you before we kick it off with our guests. One of the first things I want to mention to you is, you know, you got to hand it to those Republicans. Let's look at what they're doing in this election. They've changed the rules. They revived Jim and Juan Crow. They added new ID restrictions. They've shortened the hours, lessened the days, added amendments that are long and convoluted. They've had their operative shred applications. They use scary, threatening billboards to intimidate voters. They use robocalls that are misleading. Sounds like they understand a citizen's right to vote, huh? What do you think? Sounds like the kind of people you want to have looking out for your democracy, don't you? So keep that in mind as you prepare to vote. And speaking of vote, this news just in from our friends up in Massachusetts. It seems that the Republicans up there, opposed to Elizabeth Warren, have also had robocalls going out today, saying that Democrats voting for Elizabeth Warren should come out to vote on Wednesday, a day after the vote. So isn't that something special, huh? There's something else you should be aware of. There's a call out called Video the Vote. It goes like this. We all know what happens when elections are this close. We all remember Florida in 2000. Ohio in 2004, some of us remember Florida in 2004 and 2008. 2012 is shaping up to be no different. Already this year, we've seen hundreds of attempts to disenfranchise voters through complicated ID laws, purges of voting rolls, and voter intimidation. And according to news reports, a Koch brothers-funded group plans to challenge voters on election day across the country. We're sending you this email because you live in an area that's expected to experience troubles on election day. In past elections, it took months for the full story of voter disenfranchisement to emerge, and at that point, it was too late. That's why we're summoning up and we're teaming up with our allies at Video the Vote, asking voters like you to be part of a massive nationwide monitoring the election day vote. And here are two ways to participate, and both can make a huge difference. Sign up. Go to Video the Vote. You can document the voting irregularities locally or help research and push out the stories through the internet. Be prepared. If you see anything that looks wrong on election day, capture it with your smartphone or camera. Tag it with # Video the Vote on Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, or Ustream so that the VTV, that's Video the Vote team, can find it and push it out to the media. Whether or not you sign up, please forward this email to friends and family so that they know about the effort and they'll be prepared to help Video the Vote. That's # Video the Vote. Over the past two decades, the far right has used to make up problems of voter fraud to justify a range of tactics that serve to disenfranchise voters, particularly African American, Latino, poor people, older voters, and students. And it doesn't leave much. This year, the impact of the disenfranchised campaign could be huge. The widely respected analyst Nate Silver of the New York Times estimates that just the new voter ID laws could affect turnout in some states by as much as 2.4%. That sounds small until you remember that the 2000 election was decided by a few hundred votes in Florida. Election protection advocates have been fighting this trend every step of the way and have won some important victories, but no one really knows what will happen until Election Day. That's where the video of the vote comes in. Citizen documentation provides a critical role in scaring off those who will try to intimidate the voters and forcing the media to cover the issue. So please consider volunteering to video the vote. Okay, big spenders. A look at who's financing the constitutional amendments here in Florida. I'm sure you'll be shocked. Florida amendments matter. At least they do to the people who are spending millions to try to sway your vote. Take Amendment 8. It's entitled Religious Freedom, and it could bar the government from denying funds to organizations or institutions based on religious identity or belief. That proposal also strikes the current state ban on using state money directly or indirectly to aid any church, sect, or religious denomination, or in aid of any sectarian institution. The Archdiocese of Miami is all in on this one. It's donated $84,195 in support of the amendment, according to analysis by the Florida Center for Investigative Journalism, which looked into the money lining up for and against each of the amendments. The Archdiocese, Sister Diocese in St. Pete, Orlando, Palm Beach, have each also kicked in tens of thousands of dollars. Knights of Columbus, Catholic fraternal organizations forked over $100,000. And yet, that's tip jar money compared to the opponents of the measure pushing into the pot. ACLU of South Florida dug deep and anteed up more than $180,000 to fight the Amendment 8. Something called the Public Education Defense Fund, an arm of the Florida Education Association, says FCIR has outdone the ACLU, throwing in a cool million. Howard Simon, executive director of ACLU of Florida, acknowledged his outfit is dipping into our reserves to fight Amendment 8, but says it's actually part of a three-pronged attack on the amendment and two others, 5 and 6. Amendment 5 would give lawmakers greater sway over the makeup of the state Supreme Court, while Amendment 6 expressly prohibits the use of taxpayer funds to pay for abortion or insurance that covers abortion, except in the case of rape, incest, or when the health of the mother is in danger. Okay, I'm going to skip ahead. The ground under Fukushima has sunk 31 inches since the incident. Of course, this bodes really well for a structure completely damaged and holding radioactive waste products on its roof. Shell could, in fact, actually pay for some of the pollution damage it's done in Nigeria. So the people of Nigeria are looking for you to call upon your congressmen and women to support Nigeria's call for big oil to pay for the damage they've done in Nigeria. Also, tonight there is an alternative debate featuring Jill Stein of the Green Party, Rocky Anderson of the Justice Party, Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party, and Virgil Good of the Constitution Party. You can go to Ralph Nader, by the way, will be moderating it. And if you go to nader.org, you'll be able to find links to live stream and Ustream channels. America's nuclear safety under scrutiny after the Oyster Creek Sandy alert. We know that bad news about the Superstorm Sandy. The Jersey Shore was devastated and many towns remain waterlogged. New York suffered a direct hit and the city's mass transit system flooded and partly paralyzed for days to come. But there's good news, too, and that's what it failed to do. Sandy did not kill hundreds, as Hurricane Katrina did in New Orleans, thanks in part to timely evacuations and rescue efforts. Luckily, it did not trigger an even greater disaster at one of the region's nuclear power plants, but it could have. Watchdog groups, like the Union of Concerned Scientists, warned that America's nuclear facilities remain vulnerable to a variety of potentially catastrophic events, both natural and resulting from deliberate sabotage or cyber attacks. They say federal regulations are currently inadequate to deal with these possible disaster scenarios. And ladies and gentlemen, I think we've got our first caller. This should be President Mayfield of the Florida SEIU. Hold on just one moment. President Mayfield.
Yes.
Welcome, sir. Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Very good, sir. Very good. I was wondering, how are things going with you at SEIU tonight?
Things are going great. We're working hard to get the president reelected and trying to get good pro-worker, pro-middle-class candidates in office so we can take this country back on the right track.
Well, I'm sure you're hearing what I'm hearing, that there are waiting lines of 6 and 8 hours across South Florida. Is that what you're hearing?
Yeah, actually, the longest line that I heard was 9 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
But, yeah, there are waiting lines all over the place. And, actually, I don't know if you heard about what was going on in Miami-Dade this afternoon, where initially Miami-Dade Supervisor Elections had said that people could apply for and bring their absentee ballots to the office, gave the location, and then a lot of people showed up, and then they said, well, we're not going to accept them. So you had a couple of hundred people outside that were saying, we want to vote, we want to vote. And they eventually had to reverse course and let those people vote after about an hour.
Oh, my goodness. You know, it just seems that there is so much lined up against what we used to take for granted as a citizen's right to the vote. Let me step back just a minute and ask you a couple other questions, sir. You know, there is so much that has revitalized the union movement in the last few years. I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about SEIU, who's encompassed in it, and you know, maybe a little bit about its history, and what can you tell us about the history of SEIU, sir?
Well, SEIU has 2 million members, over 2 million members nationally. We are the largest union in North America. Over a million of our members are actually healthcare, nurses, home care attendants, people that work in nursing homes. So we have been on the forefront of the social justice movement for over 50 years. The organization started in New York with janitors, and it grew from there. So the past, I would say, 10, 15 years under the guidance of Andy Stern, who was the former president, the organization really proliferated a strong political presence, and we tried to take a different track, seceding from the AFL-CIO at one point, and taking a more aggressive stance as it relates to social justice issues and politics. We have a new president, Mary Kay Henry, who was elected earlier this year. And so we're really committed to figuring out how we reestablish SEIU, as well as the greater labor movement, as part of the greater political community and the greater community at large. I think, and this is my personal assessment, I think that at different points in time, labor has done a poor job of doing the interface of our members being part of the community. They go to churches, they live in the community, they receive services. But we have to do a better job of making that connection on the very local level as well as what we do nationally.
You know, it seems to me that while maybe the union didn't do everything it could to reach out to the broader community, I would say also that many of our elected Democrats have fallen way short of providing the backup and the bully pulpit as well as a hard line to defend the rights of working Americans. And I'm so pleased to see the union movement take this very seriously, and instead of being one more group the Democrats at all can count on, the Democrats are going to have to step up to the plate and earn that support, because that's the way it should be.
Well, I agree with you 1,000%. I think that our focus, we do support a lot of Democrats. We also support Republicans also, and people who are not necessarily affiliated with a direct political party. Our concern is making sure that those who we support financially and our members who knock doors and work on behalf of candidates, that they're working in the best interest of working families. That is the most important thing. I think that the biggest problem, if you look at the trajectory of the Democratic Party was really, changes in campaign finance reform and the rise of money in politics to an extremely large level. I think corporate interests realized at some point that if they spread their money around, that they could get that they could have influence regardless of who was ever in elected office. And because of that, they have used money as a way to directly attack labor rights and the rights of workers. And I think that it's our job to make sure that people understand we don't just represent the members who are in our union. We represent all workers, even workers who are unemployed. And we have to change labor law in this country to make sure that it is representative of the needs of our communities and not just give back to big corporations and special interests.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. So, you look at the tort reform movement and other things where you have laws that have been enacted that only benefit a very small group of people, and they don't benefit workers. They don't benefit the common man. And so we have to change that.
You know, it's funny. The effectiveness of this million-dollar propaganda that has rained down on working Americans, where they, for many people, they seem to have actually convinced them that that union workers, that especially government workers, who we used to call civil servants, and even first responders have been besmirched and have been somehow made to be the villain. And I find that extraordinary. All these people that complain about unions, I don't see any of them insisting on working a 7-day work week, 14 hours, and giving up vacations that, of course, all came from the hard sweat, labor, and in fact, life and death that was earned by union workers.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. It's at its core, divide and conquer. So when you look at, for example, constitutional amendments like Amendment 3, which, is really to limit the government's ability to be able to provide services to its constituency, that's a divide and conquer technique that wants to pit one group of the citizenry against another. And it's done under the guise to basically say, you know what, government is too big, blah, 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 blah. But everyone, I think if you were to ask people, and if they were being honest, people want to be able to have their trash picked up. People want to be able to, if they go to the hospital, not wait 12 hours. People want to be able to have EMTs that can come pick them up in case of an emergency. They want their houses put out in case of a fire. They want police. They want teachers. That's what, are the building blocks of society. But there's been an attack on these workers to try to devalue the work that they do because there are private interests out there who only view those people as cogs in a much bigger machine and their salaries as budget that they can just siphon off.
Well, I think the irony was pretty thick when all these people, I have to imagine there were one or two teabaggers up in the New Jersey, New York area who suddenly maybe had a second thought about shutting down FEMA and privatizing firemen and firing fire people and first responders, because you know what? Maybe they realize that these are people who society invests in to help when absolutely necessary.
Right. And I think the sad part about it is, there's actually more money in the economy now than there was before the crash in 2007. That money is just concentrated in much fewer hands, and it's also being sent out of the country. So, if you look at it, you have millions and billions of dollars that are being siphoned out of the community. That happens when you have bad legislation that's passed that gives tax breaks to corporations that don't need them. And also when there are cuts to social programs that people need and use, because those people actually put their money back in the community. Any public sector worker, 70% of what they make goes directly right back into the local community. And if you look at the modifier effects for that money, what happens when it changes hands, that's the driving force of our communities, that and small businesses. Well, they're they're directly under the attack from multinational corporations who only look at the bottom line and only worry about profit.
Yeah, well, the bottom line, unfortunately, must consider the cement that holds the mortar of civilization together. Teachers who are essentially responsible for training tomorrow's citizens have to be compensated. The people that protect, well, I'm preaching to the choir. I just think that Sandy gave the teabaggers a profound slap in the head for anybody who's listening.
Well, you know, I don't know if you've noticed, but there were rankings of the top countries as relates to education level and student achievement, and I think Norway was number one, and I forget who was number two. But basically, what they found is that the difference in those countries from countries like ours that have seen a slide over the past 30, 40 years, is that in those countries, teachers are paid as much as doctors. And that profession is treated as such with significant honor because it's a gateway. They held so many minds in their hand, and it's a gateway to the betterment of all society. And so, you know, seeing that correlation, I think is pretty obvious. But when there's a devaluing of that work, and there's also a scapegoating of those workers, then, you know, people sometimes want very simple answers to very complex problems. And I think that we have to have a serious discussion about the future of education in this country. But we also have to have a very serious discussion about the future of the middle class in this country. And to me, those things are connected because
absolutely
we have to train children for the future economy. And, you know, that can go a lot of different ways.
Well, let me ask you this, sir. I have the good fortune to have as my next guest Miss Arlene Holt Baker, Executive Vice President of the National AFL-CIO. And one of the things she said to me that gave me just a really good feeling, probably a better feeling I've had for a long time. She said that even after the elections, the political work of the AFL-CIO is going to continue. She said the plan is to keep the Democrats' feet to the fire. This cat food commission, whether we get an Obama administration or a Romney administration, we know they're going to try to put this whole fake expenditure problem on the lap of the middle class. And we can't have that. So the work has to continue. Do you see the SEIU doing the same thing, sir?
Almost definitely. We're going to work November 7th. And tell her I said hello. And then SEIU says hello to when you talk to her.
I will.
We're going to work the day after the election, focusing on not just, you know, the presidential politics and Congress and Senate, but also going all the way down ballot. We have to keep legislature's feet to the fire, too. You look at some of the wacky legislation that's taken place in Florida over the past 20 years, and it's absurd. It's doing the community a disservice, and we have to push them. And we also have to offer a counter-narrative. And so I think that that's the job of SEIU and Change to Win and the AFL-CIO to make sure that we're bringing as many people to this fight as possible.
Well, sir, I want to thank you so much. If there's one message you want to leave my listeners as they approach the final days of the election, do you want to make a comment, sir, about the election coming up?
Sure. I would say this. I would say if you're thinking about not voting, vote. I would say if you care about your future, your kids' future, if you're 45 or 30 and want to be able to retire and have some retirement security, I would say vote for the president. I would also say vote no on all the amendments because they're all bad, and the ones that aren't bad are used as a canard to try to deceive people. So we have to take this country back, and we have to do it legislatively, and we have to put people in the streets to do it. So let's not allow democracy to be taken away from us step by step by step. Let's stand up, and standing up for us is by voting.
Well, sir, absolutely. I know this House has voted. And I know many people have already voted. Let's just hope that the Republican shenanigans don't impact the electronic tallies because the news doesn't sound good in that direction. Let's wish us all luck on that count, huh?
Yes. Yes.
Well, sir, thank you so very much. I sure appreciate you coming, and I'd love to have you back again, okay?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, keep up the good work with SEIU. Good night, sir. Okay. Well, that was Alphonse Mayfield, president of Florida SEIU. Obviously, union workers who are protecting us, who are helping the hungry, the needy, who are cleaning up, who are making this world a better place every day. It's not just a slogan, friends. Those of us who are working every day to make this a better place, we are making an impact. This is a better world because of the work that we do. And also, don't forget, if you haven't voted yet and you're going to go vote in person, keep an eye out and keep yourself some time. They're talking 6, 8, 9 hours. Okay. There's another interesting story coming out of Fukushima. It says there's a second mass complaint coming over Fukushima disaster. More than 10,000 people from across Japan are seeking criminal charges against the officials of Japanese government and the utility that operated the Fukushima No. 1 nuclear plant. After a similar mass complaint this summer accused 33 officials of causing death and injury through negligence. Prosecutors in the Fukushima prefecture are currently examining the earlier complaint filed in June by 1,300 people who were residents of the prefecture at time of the accident in March 2011. Complainants behind the new case plan to file it with the Fukushima District Public Prosecutor's Office on November 15th. The group numbers about 10,850 individuals from Hokkaido in the north to Okinawa in the south. The group is led by Ruiko Muto, 59, who traveled around the country seeking support. Complainants argue that broadly backed complaint would show that the general public is seeking criminal accountability for those who promoted nuclear power and to hold them responsible for the damage from the disaster and for exposing victims to radiation. And with that, I now bring you the interview with Ms. Arlene Holt-Baker, Executive Vice President, the National AFL-CIO.
I'm ready.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Arlene Holt-Baker, Executive Vice President of National AFL-CIO. Arlene, welcome.
Good morning, and thank you so much, Rick. I'm so pleased to be with you.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I come from union roots that go back a long ways. I hail from the Northeast. My family worked on the railroad and in union halls in the steel mills, so I have a lot of sympathy with the union movement, and I know, because of my studies of history, how much the union has meant to the working people of this country. So I want to thank you for the work that you do for the AFL-CIO. Having said that, let me ask you, what do you do for the AFL-CIO, and what are your tasks, what are your roles, and what are you up to now?
Well, I'm the Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO, and very proud to represent 12 million union members, including our Working America associates. What I'm engaged in at the AFL-CIO as Executive Vice President certainly is to be a part of making sure that our policies for working people are moving forward in many ways. But what I do that absolutely grounds me every single day is my work with working with our coalition partners. We certainly, in the labor movement, what we do, we are strengthened not only by the work of our own membership, but more strength comes when we are working in collaboration with community partners and allies. So I work a lot with helping to make that bridge with labor and community.
You know, it's so interesting to see how workers' rights have evolved from the turn of the last century to the turn of this century. You know, if you picture the workers in the late 1800s, early 1900s, a lot of factory work, a lot of, you know, large groups of people working on a task, relatively, you know, low intellectual engagement, lots of hands-on kind of thing. They had a chance to talk, they had a chance to think. Now today's, if you will, the I guess one of the phrases is the knowledge workers. We tend to work in smaller groups, and I think that's played a part in the narrowing of people who have access to union bargaining strength. Do you see anything in the...
I think you are absolutely right there. It's a different kind of workforce. But when you talk about even my own background, I came into this movement. I went to work for AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, Public Sector Unions. And at that point, when I was organizing in the state of California, after workers were able to get bargaining rights at the city, county, state, and state level, it was an environment where you certainly... public sector, we had access to workers, and there were, you know, a large workforce where people were interacting with each other on a daily basis. And certainly we're starting to see some change in the workforce, because in so many places you don't have the large concentration of workers where they can talk and exchange together. So it is a changing environment. But even with that changing environment, what we find that's interesting is that even the polling bears this out. When you talk to workers today, even the young workers are coming into the, you know, workforce, not at the level that they'd certainly like to be, the one thing that still rings true, even though it's very difficult for workers to bargain and organize today because of all the prohibitions against it by employers, there still is this willingness on the majority of workers in this country to say that they would like and believe it's necessary to come together collectively to have a voice in the workplace. There's still this desire, but there's, as we both know, so much intimidation and harassment that happens when they try to do so.
Absolutely. You know, when you look at the force that ALEC has had in state legislatures across the country with all kinds of anti-union activity, the whole, you know, the terrible debacle that went down in Wisconsin, how these people have reframed the public servants, the people who work to serve the men and women of this country in government offices, how they have demonized them. They've even, in large part, effectively demonized first responders, which, in my opinion, just beggars the imagination.
Well, you see, what it's a divide and conquer is what they attempted to do in Wisconsin, Ohio, and so many other places. And to believe that there is this anti-movement against public sector workers, well, it backfired on them in Ohio, and certainly we were able to stop them from gutting collective bargaining in Ohio. And certainly we saw it happening in Wisconsin with the governor. But what, unfortunately, for so many who've been devastated by Sandy and its impact in the recent days, what America has seen and been reminded of again, of how very important our public sector workers are. Our first responders are critically important. We've always said this, to the safety of all of our communities. So I think as we're looking and seeing these horrific images of those impacted by Sandy, what we see are the brave men and women, public servants, whether they be nurses, firefighters, police officers, who are coming to the aid, risking their own lives to save others. Where would we be without that safety net of the public sector? So they constantly try to demonize it, those on the right, but every now and then something happens in a magnitude, unfortunately it's too often tragic, but a magnitude that makes us understand the incredible value that our public service workers bring to the tapestry of our country. We could not survive as a nation without them.
You know, I agree with you completely. I think in an interesting sort of way, this experience for America with Sandy, it certainly turned Mitt Romney and his ilk and their idea of shutting down FEMA and shutting down government and making government so small, I think it turned it on its ear. I think you're absolutely right. It made people think about it in a completely different way.
Well, we have to. I mean, it takes all of us together. I mean, certainly at every level, the local level, the state level, the federal level, and we have to come together. We have to be there for one another. And, I mean, just look at what we've been saying for so long, Rick. we have been saying, let's go with the jobs piece. We said, okay, so many Americans are unemployed. But we have an opportunity, quite frankly, to put America back to work. The president introduced, you know, his transportation bill to put people back to work. And some of these governors rejected the money. We know, like, the Rick Scotts of the world in Florida, and we know the Scott Walkers, and even a Chris Christie, right? They didn't want to take this money. But we were saying, there is a way to put our people back to work, but what we know is we need to build up America's infrastructure because we have a crumbling infrastructure that does not work. Well, again, here we are, and again, so unfortunate, so horrible. This is not the way you want it to happen, but we now, in those corridors of the Northeast that Sandy has impacted, so there will be a rethinking of so much, and there will be a real building, and it has to be of the infrastructure in so many ways. And so this is an opportunity for us, I think, quite frankly, around the country. Let us not wait for disaster, but let's reexamine where we are in our infrastructure around this country, and let's make sure that it's shored up to withstand these kind of devastations that could possibly happen.
You make such a wonderful point. The infrastructure in New York and New Jersey, the whole Northeast there, is going to be looked at closely, and America is going to have to decide, can we afford to not invest in infrastructure? And I think the answer has to be a profound no. Let me ask you another question. We have... We've hoped that the union movement has hoped for a long time that the Democrats will make a full-throated common cause, and unfortunately, I think too many Democratic leaders have forgotten how much work the unions put in to get them elected. And I'm wondering, do you think there are ways we can help remind these Democrats who so many of us have worked hard to elect, to remind them of the working class people? They shouldn't be just responding to lobbyists. They shouldn't just be responding to these high-priced lobbyists.
Well, let me say this too, Rick. Yes, certainly the labor movement has worked very hard in many cases, and quite frankly, many of them got their margin of victory because of working people that came out of union households. But what we have learned, and it's been a bitter lesson in many cases, we elect people that say they're for working people, but then sometimes even our friends get in and they don't support the policies that would enhance the lives of working people economically and in socially in some instances. What we've probably not done a good enough job of, but you better believe we're going to do it now, is we're going to make sure that we hold them accountable. And what we're going to be engaged in immediately after this election is, yes, we're working hard to elect and send back to Congress people who support working families. It's about working families. And I'll say again, Democrats, we know, perform much better and vote much better on a whole when it comes to working family issues. We as a labor movement have not tended to say we're for Republicans or Democrats. It's just that the facts are what they are. Democrats are much better on the issues. Are they where they should be in all cases? Absolutely not. But we have to hold them accountable. Immediately after this election, we will go into holding them accountable. And it's two things that we're going to be looking for them to do right now. When they return to Washington, what we're going to say is, you be there, you have some backbone, you stand your ground, and you let these Bush tax cuts expire. And we're saying you do not go along with putting on the chopping block Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That will not be acceptable. And so our operation, we are not going to close down, if you will, after victory on Tuesday, but it is going to be up and operational around this country 365 days a year, and we're never going to let up again in holding our politicians accountable. And if they don't, even our friends, even those who purport to be our friends, it's not, don't tell us you're our friends. Right now, it's about you show us how you vote on policies that have a positive impact on shared prosperity for our nation. If you can't do that, you are not a friend to working families.
Oh boy, Arlene, I just love that. You made an old heart I hold Union hard. Go Pitter Pat, that's for sure. Because, you know.
Well, I mean, it is what it is, and you know, we're tired. We don't have time in the country. You either stand up, for what is right, or you know, as far as we're concerned, if we'd help you get there, we don't want to believe that we made any mistakes. But the best persons to tell the story, if you will, is the people that come from their communities, and that's going to be what's going to be happening. It's going to be their constituents, and I mean every single day we're going to make sure that constituents, especially coming from our union households, are on top of what their elected officials are doing, and if they're not doing the right thing, friend or foe, we're calling you out.
I think that's absolutely the best tactic. And it's something we all have to do. I see more and more comments like that in the progressive press, where they're saying this isn't just about a 4-year cycle. If we're going to make progress, if we're going to make traction, whether it be on family issues or medical health care issues or environmental issues, this can't be over on the 7th of November. This has to be a year-round, 24/7, 365. That's the only way we're going to make progress, because right now
it's absolutely the only way, because I mean so many things that we've thought in our country that, you know, were okay and they were safe. Let's look at what's happening around voter suppression issues.
Oh my God.
Now, I would have never thought that here we are in 2012 that I would have seen our country in states around this country, almost actually 38 of them, introduce measures that would have made it more difficult for people to participate in democracy. Some of these introductions of these laws, such as the ones for voter ID requirements that were in Wisconsin, which we've, at least the courts have stayed, Pennsylvania, this is no different than we were in a Jim Crow era and the days of poll tax.
Yeah.
And I mean, for me personally, I look back, I was, you know, 14 years old when in 1965 when they passed the Voting Rights Act. But my mama, who was, you know, now we say domestic worker, but then a maid in Texas, had to pay poll tax. And I remember asking mother for a pair of shoes. I mean, I must have been about, I'm thinking I'm 8 or 10 years old, and I said, you know, I wanted some shoes. And needed them. I mean, not wanted. I mean, it was needed. But that poor maid, and I'm going to use the term of that time, said, Arlene, baby, I can't afford them because I've got to pay my poll tax. Now, my mama was making less than $4 a day. That poll tax may have been $2. I don't know what then it was. I could go back and research what Texas poll tax exactly was. But the fact was that she had to sacrifice to pay it. That should not have been that hard for my mother to be able to participate in her democracy, but it was. But after 1965, that was all behind us. But here we are again with all these obstacles that have been put in the way to stop voters from being able to participate. And then this targeting, Rick, when you look at this agenda of these right-wing folk, you say, well, how does that relate? Why are the working people and why is the union concerned about voter suppression? Well, guess what? Let's look at a pattern here. Wisconsin, Ohio, Florida, states that introduce voter suppression laws. Wisconsin, Ohio, Florida, Indiana, also Indiana, same thing with the voter suppression piece, also introduced legislation to limit collective bargaining for workers. So they have attacked workers, saying that workers shouldn't have a voice in the workplace. They've introduced legislation to stop large percentages of people of color, young people, and poor people from being able to exercise their right in the polling booth. The attack on immigrants. When you look at this attack and where it's coming from, so if you take out the worker and the worker's voice, you limit the voice of a coalition of people, the young, the people of color, the poor, and then you go after the immigrants. They think they can control and have power in this country for the 1%. We're not letting it happen, Rick. We can't let it happen. That's why we have to be on our job 365 days a year, because these folk are thinking every day about how they can limit our ability for shared prosperity and present that, you know, represent that 1%, and quite frankly, let the rest of us go down. It's problematic. The attacks, the way they've come, and you look at these states, there's a pattern.
I'd sure like to see the Justice Department notice that this voter suppression is a plan, and it is part and parcel of destroying our democracy. When you look at that, you look at the control of these voting machines with no tabulation, with no paper trail. These are closed systems. They're not transparent. There is clearly a plan to disenfranchise American voters. And if there's anything more dangerous to democracy, I can't think of what it is.
To me, there's two pieces to this. When you talk about a strong democracy, if we want to keep it, if we want to keep our democracy and keep it strong, you've got to have a balance between employers and workers. So you, in order to have a strong democracy, you've got to have a strong labor movement. I absolutely believe that. And in order to have a strong democracy, people have to be able to freely exercise their right to vote without this intimidation and harassment. If you're able to interfere in those two areas, then our democracy as we know it will not exist. And so we have to be vigilant as progressives, and quite frankly, as Americans who care about democracy, to fight every single day, even when we sometimes think that we're okay, never closing our eyes, always fighting to ensure that workers have the ability to bargain collectively so that we can have that balance of power, and that all citizens of this country have access to the ballot box without this intimidation and harassment that's going on in our country. America's better than this, and if we're going to make sure that it continues to move forward, we've got to always keep our eyes, our ears open on what's happening to our democracy.
Wow. Truer words were never said. Tell me, Arlene, are there... You mentioned this plan to continue. I think that's fantastic. I agree with you 100%. Are there any other works in motion? Are there strategies being developed to try to capture more of the knowledge workers? I think it's really one of the big challenges that faces the union movement. Too many technical people, too many computer people, knowledge workers, information workers, whatever you want to call it, really feel isolated. They really feel they have absolutely no options whatsoever. They tend to work in very small groups, and it's very difficult to get them engaged in some kind of work action. Is there a think tank, a union think tank somewhere that's kind of working on ways that we can help these people with their job relations?
Well, there absolutely is, and what we're doing at the AFL-CIO and within our union movement is we have this new campaign, if you will. It's part of our repositioning, but we are engaged, and our Secretary-Treasurer, Liz Shuler, who's the Secretary-Treasurer, young woman at the AFL-CIO, is thinking about the young worker, and we're saying the next up, this new generation. We know that we're going to have to reach out to them in a different way. So much is around, you know, they do so much with social media.
Uh-huh.
It's so much is, and that's the way the communication goes. So we are looking at ways and strategies of how you can get them involved. Now, again, even with the polling of young people, they still believe in this collective action. It may not be collective action in the workforce as we know it, as I say, from the old school way, but it's a new way for them to at least communicate with each other, and I think that the social networks give that opportunity, and we've got to find ways for them to connect with one another and share their experiences, and then, you know, find ways when there's a way that and time to take collective action towards something. So certainly our unions are looking at that. How do you organize in this new era? The other piece of it, Rick, is that we see trending is that so many workers now, employers, you know, convince them that, well, you're contract workers. So this whole attitude of, well, you know, I don't really, you know, have a boss, I'm my own boss. Well, you know, of course, that works for many employers, because what, when you're your own boss, guess what? Employer doesn't pay that health care. Employer doesn't have, you don't have a pension, although more and more Americans, unfortunately, don't have that, and we've got to change that, too, because still, those who have a union, majority of people of unions still have real pensions today. But this whole attitude, this notion toward, you know, contract work, that I'm a contractor, we're looking more with that, too, and figuring out how do you organize that group of workers. One of the things that we are doing that I really know that people do want to be engaged and they want to act collectively, it's through our program Working America. That's our associate-based membership with the AFL-CIO. We have recruited just in the last 4 or 5 years, almost 3 million Working America members, where we're going door to doors in communities, who knocking on doors of people who aren't in unions and talking about the issues that impact them. Certainly it's about the economy, it's about education, you know, in some cases they're concerned about the environment, whatever that issue is, and they're joining Working America. Now, are they able to, you know, we bargain? No, they can't bargain, but they can come together in their communities and fight for policies that, as I said, move in the direction that they believe it should move in for their communities to create shared prosperity and address some of their economic and social concerns. So we're going to have to look at new ways in organizing workers that may not be the traditional way as we know it. And we are, you know, looking at some of those examples of how we can do it, models rather, of how we can do it.
I was wondering, are there any models in Europe that we can look at in terms of knowledge workers or information workers, where because they have maybe more engaged the union process, the union what's a good way of putting it? I guess the union paradigm in their work. And I was wondering if you've heard of anything from the Europe that might be, you know, reworked into a more American paradigm.
What I'd love to do is look at maybe some of those models, and then we have another conversation I'd love to, where we can maybe look at some models, and possibly we'd have one of our sisters and brothers from the European Union be a part of this conversation to see what's working for them. But what I do know is that, you know, a lot, let's look at these worker centers, again, but that's not maybe so much the knowledge-based worker, but there may be opportunities to look at worker centers, if you will, for knowledge-based workers. We certainly have it for, you know, domestic workers here. We have it for other workers, but it may be some kind of worker center concept, at least where knowledge-based workers can come together and collaborate together about conditions. So
you know,
there are ways, but I'd love to look at some of the European models, really examine them, and then get back with you on the show, and we talk about what we may or may not be working in Europe relative to organizing the knowledge-based worker.
Super. And, you know, I'd love to have you, we can schedule also another talk when you can talk just about the Working American concept. I think that's a really neat idea. And could be very helpful.
Oh, I tell you, I just think it's fabulous. And again, it just shows us that people want to be engaged. First of all, people want somebody to ask them, you know, what's on your mind? What are you thinking about? And they want to find a way to be engaged. And as we know, the union density isn't where it used to be in this country, so it's not like they're going to the union hall, and because so many workers aren't a part of unions because of the laws that prevent that and make, because of the intimidation and harassment that occurs when they try to organize. But so this whole community organizing component is really important. And then when you can organize the community and they understand the importance of workers having collective bargaining, then the community can come to bear on issues as it relates to workers and their ability to bargain, and putting pressure on our politicians to make sure that they're passing laws that support the workers' right to have a voice in the workplace, as opposed to introducing laws that would limit that voice.
Arlene, this has been a tremendous talk. If I could ask you something personal, I would ask you this. it to me, I find most people, most progressives, you know, we have our lives, we have our work, and we try to do something for the community. We try to have a life of some kind, but that extra something that makes us get engaged, that makes us try to do a little something to help. What was it in your life that took you beyond being just another consumer, and made you take part of your life and say, I want to help? What was it for you?
Well, growing up in a segregated community in Texas, surrounded by poverty, a mother that was a domestic worker who struggled every day to make ends meet, a father who was a day laborer, quite frankly, who went out and some days found work, some days he didn't. But what that moved me, but it was in 1968, I think, that really moved me to say that I wanted to be engaged in social and economic justice work and fighting for social justice. I mean, that certainly gave me my foundation. But in 1968, my father was killed in a car accident in March of that year. Then on April the 4th, Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. And in June, Bobby was assassinated. And my father, although it was difficult for him sometimes to bring money home because the jobs, you know, weren't there, we lost somebody who attempted to provide for his family. He was gone. The only thing that my mother had then was Social Security, and still her job as a maid. I thought, it has to be better than this. Dr. King and his fight for social and economic justice, and there the dreamer had been killed. And I thought, they won't kill the dream in me, and I will fight on. And my belief that Bobby Kennedy would have made our lives so much better as a president had he lived, but the loss of Bobby. And I decided then that I could either just cry every single day as a 16-year-old, or I could try to do something in my life that would work, make it better for my family, for my community, and my country. And that's when I decided I'd want to be engaged in social activity, and I then went to work for a union that has provided me in many ways an opportunity that I would, quite frankly, pay to do this work if I could, because every single day I get up doing something I hope that is helping to improve the lives of communities around this country so that we can have shared prosperity and that every one of our citizens is truly treated with the kind of respect and dignity that our Constitution talks about.
Thank you so much for the work that you do every day, because that work does make a difference in so many lives. And I want to thank you so much, Arlene, for being with us. We'll be in touch. I want to set up two additional sessions.
Yes, let's talk about some of the modeling that we're seeing. Love to have that conversation. And then to talk further about our wonderful Working America Associate Membership Program at the AFL-CIO.
Thank you so very much, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. I'm in Ohio, so I hope not only will we have a wonderful day, but it will be great results on Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, I look forward to waking up, holding accountable all of those friends of working families to make sure that we do the right thing on behalf of Americans, and that we move our country forward, and that we have a country that's values is about shared prosperity for all.
Thank you so much, Ms. Arlene Holtbaker, Executive Vice President, National AFL-CIO. Thank you again, Arlene. I look forward to talking to you soon.
Okay, Rick. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to hurry up and get right to Dennis Campbell, who's going to talk about an amazing story he's covering right now on vote rigging. Here we go. Dennis Campbell, Progressive UK publisher. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Dennis Campbell, publisher and chief producer of UK Progressive. Dennis, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here again.
International author, journalist extraordinaire. Dennis, you've got a big story. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I've known a gentleman now for 17 years. He was my neighbor when I lived in Laurel, Maryland. His expertise is he spent 17 years as an NSA analyst. And so as an analyst, you know, you're constantly breaking down, decoding, working with computers, working with systems. So he has a special amount of knowledge on the issue of systems and hacking. I've been working and talking to Michael Donahoe, that's his name, for the better part of 6 years. He's been relocated from Maryland to Tucson, where he's retired. And we're working with a group of people that have been focused on trying to get behind what happened in Pima County, Arizona. Now, we know Maricopa County because that's the home of Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Phoenix, and that's the main seat. But Pima County tends to be a bit of a liberal bastion that surrounds the city of Tucson. And in 2006, they had an RTA election, or a Rural Transit Authority bond election, that went the way everybody expected it to go, but there were huge variances in the numbers. And to make a long story short, there was a group of citizens there that began to take a look at how the election was being conducted, what systems were in place, how they were being used, and they found a number of irregularities that could only be resolved by doing a hand count of the actual paper ballots and comparing them to some of the precinct results coming out of the machine. There's a film out there called Hacking Democracy, and they saw how these particular machines could be hacked by both the memory cards at the machine level as well as in the central tabulation GEMS computer. So I've been following that for 5 or 6 years with a number of stories, not anywhere near to the extent of Brad Friedman and the Brad blog and others, but this particular case intrigued me because Michael came to me and said, Dennis, I'd really like you to take a look at this because I think there's something here. Now, he's a very soft-spoken individual, and 2 days before my story ran, an email hit my inbox from Michael that said, stop the presses. Now, that obviously got my attention because he's probably the least histrionic, the least conspiracy theory, the least tinfoil hat member of any group that's out there. This guy is rock solid, and when he says, something's wrong, I immediately picked up the phone. It was about 10 o'clock in the evening, his time, very early in the morning, my time, and he talked me through what was going on. And, you know, of course, when you start in a conversation with Mickey, you start at a very detailed mathematical level. I said, okay, help me explain this in terms that a layperson would understand. And as we began to work our way through it, I literally gasped and said, holy, you know what, this was huge. This was one of those stories that you look at and you say, okay, just as they were saying throughout the Democratic Convention, it's mathematics, this is also mathematics. And the math didn't make sense. What he found was that the larger the precinct became, the more the total votes for Mitt Romney suddenly went up, and the more the total for votes of Ron Paul and Rick Santorum went down. And that was basically the thesis behind the initial set of research and number crunching that they'd done. What had happened was that Michael, and I call him Mickey because that's the name he goes by, Mickey, had received an email from somebody pointing him towards a study by this guy, Francois Chiquette, and James Parker. These two gentlemen have mathematic backgrounds within two of the Cal. One is with Cal, and another one is with another major university, which escapes me at the moment. They've been doing an analysis of all of the votes during the South Carolina primary. That's where they started. And the only reason it got their interest, because a poll worker had remarked to them, this is strange. Why is it only in the biggest and largest of precincts do I see an excessive amount of votes and activity going towards Romney? It doesn't make sense because it's not happening anyplace else. So they ran a detailed analysis. They went to the Secretary of State's office, which you can do to any Secretary of State office in the United States. They downloaded the raw vote totals for every election, which was stored, their public record. And what they did then, and they were able to get all that information by precinct. And they took that information by precinct, they put it into a spreadsheet. Then they sorted the data by the smallest precinct, the smallest number of votes cast, to the largest number of votes cast. Then they did it cumulatively so they'd have something to compare against. And they found the same thing was happening in every one of the 50 states except for Utah. And we thought the reason for Utah being excluded was he had such a huge lead, there was no need for it. They then went back in their study and they looked at every national, congressional election, including presidential election, all the way back. I think they went as far back as 2002. And the same things were happening, not for Romney, obviously, because he wasn't in all the elections, but there was the same factor where there was roughly a 10% flip inside the system for the GOP candidate, the Republican candidate. And that was when there was enough evidence in terms of the smoking gun that I ran with the story that I ran with, which was the first story. They then, after that first story, over the next 48 hours, did a series of additional tests because they're mathematicians, they're analysts. They really wanted to get underneath the numbers. They found even more correlations. They did screens by party. They did screens by several voter IDs to make sure that they weren't just blowing in the wind here. And each time the numbers came back saying, something's not right here. And it was system-wide and it was nationwide. And the only thing it showed was that, you know, this was something that was happening at a very, very high level. And it could very well even involve collusion between the five companies. So it was extraordinary. And once we had that, we've had so many hundreds of thousands of hits on the article on UK Progressive. The video is up to, I think, about 40,000 views that I did with David Packman, because I said to David, let's launch this together. So I posted it right as his show went on the air live. We'd obviously recorded our segment an hour or so before. So it got the extra impact, and I also posted it on Daily Coast. And I also co-authored this with a man by the name of Charlie James up in Toronto, Canada, who's a journalist whom I have a tremendous amount of respect for. He contributes to UK Progressive, and he's, you know, former Business Week editor. He's really a top-flight journalist for a number of years. So once we had all this together, and I had Charlie checking my back to make sure that we, you know, covered everything, we were really making sure we had a strong story. He brought in information from Ohio and from Florida to complete the story. We had something that we could really run with, and I think the results speak for themselves because, you know, we're not a bunch of, as I say, tinfoil hat-wearing conspiracy theorists. We said something's not right. And here we are 4 days away now, or 2 days away when this airs, from, you know, a very big election with huge results in swing states where this stuff has been known to have occurred.
This is powerful information. And when you add this up with the kind of electoral mischief, and I use a light word because, frankly, the appropriate characterization, in my opinion, is treasonous. You look at election tampering. You look at voter restrictions. You look at these new onerous guidelines for voting. You look at the caging of voters. You look at this disenfranchisement, these fake charges of non-citizen voting. What you see is an across-the-board attack on democracy. You just have to wonder, with all of these what I'm going to call technical attacks on the election system. It seems unfortunate that the awareness level of this these terrible crimes is so low. I've seen this story in a couple progressive outlets, but like so many important stories, it seems nowhere near the mainstream media, although clearly you're getting some mainstream media over in Britain.
Yeah, it's there clearly is a desire and need to suppress this story, and it because of the very things in which you've said that, you know, this would be treasonous, this would be well beyond the pale. This is something that could never happen here because we don't have electronic voting systems. Everything's done by paper. It sometimes takes 2 or 3 days before we know the final result. But you know what? People know that their ballot is cast and they know that it's counted. And that's very important. And I feel that there's this false level of security. For example, I wrote a follow-up story on this whole issue, and I had the Arizona Star, which is the newspaper there in Pima County, came out in their Sunday magazine, which is read by 300,000 people, roughly one-third of the people who will cast ballots, basically saying, we've put in new security measures and the voting system is safe. And that is patently false, but when you have that level of control, like what you're seeing now with Fox totally ignoring anything to do with Hurricane Sandy and focusing on Benghazi and any other conspiracy theory, basically throwing everything they can against the wall in Obama to see what will stick, it is such a bastardization of democracy that I don't even know where to start. And I think part of the problem is that these are like cockroaches in the kitchen. You turn the light on, you can see the last two or three scurry, but if you can see them, you have no idea how many are underneath the woodwork worming their way through. When I wrote the book on the war on women, the Vagina Wars, I was stunned to see 944 separate pieces of legislation come out in a four-month period, sponsored by and created by ALEC, and done in such a way that you're literally playing whack-a-mole, just as you are with the voter suppression efforts. You're literally trying, just as soon as you stop something going bad in Ohio, something pops up in Pennsylvania, you whack that one, something comes up in Wisconsin, you whack that one, you're dealing in Michigan. They're just overwhelming the system because there's this arrogance and this smugness that they know they can get away with whatever they want to get away with because the corporate media will not hold them to task, nor will anybody else. We've seen zero stories about voter suppression in the mainstream media. It's not the issue that should be, yet every citizen is affected by this, every voting citizen, and it doesn't matter what your party affiliation is, and yet they're mum on it. We've seen nothing in the mainstream media but derision, and even in the progressive media. I mean, I was shocked to see Think Progress go after David Pakman and Brad Friedman and others, you know, saying, oh, it's just conspiracy theorists and just ignore it, the voting system is safe, when everybody knows that's just BS. And so there has to be a fundamental change, win or lose on Tuesday, in the way in which we go about things. I mean, if the progressives lose on Tuesday, we cannot spend 2 years pouting. Everything that you believe in will be gone. You know, when the Republicans lose, they fight back even harder. I mean, the vote tally wasn't even counted, and the celebration in Grant Park finished when they were planning their revenge. The inauguration address wasn't delivered when they planned to obstruct President Obama's every move. We've got to fight fire with fire, yet we continue to bring a paper cutter to a knife fight, and it's not working.
It's so beyond sobering. I don't know if you've heard these stories, but supposedly there's been a, you'll love this, a misprint on some of the ballots in Palm Beach County that's going to render, they said, in the neighborhood of 60,000 ballots worthless. There's another story that in the county that I live, Martin County, there's an error and an omission on some of the ballots that they didn't even characterize how many, that maybe thousands of these will be spoilt as well. And we understand from the tactics they've used in the past, they're not trying to damage everything. They're trying to take a couple thousand here, a couple thousand there, 10,000 here, 10,000 there. And when they can make it look like it's such a narrow margin, suddenly that 10,000, 20,000, 100,000 votes becomes the actual margin of their victory. And it is...
And look what happened in Wisconsin, where that woman suddenly found, after their candidate had lost, it was 7,000 ballots. Ooh, oops, mistake on my part. I mean, we've politicized the election process. I mean, there was a piece on Thursday night by Rachel Maddow, in which she showed the election calendar as to when exactly what time in the evening we should be looking for results and state polls to close. And at the tail end, she had the 10 states that were likely going to be the most important ones, and she showed the political affiliation of the Secretary of State in each of those. And 6 of the 10 were Republican, who have all been in very highly politicized efforts to suppress the vote, to delay the vote. They fought in court. I mean, this idiot in Ohio has now totally ignored the local court, the appeals court, the federal court, and the Supreme Court. And he's still in his job and still sitting in his chair when he should have been, you know, hauled out of there in leg irons and somebody else put in charge to say, do what the court said, which is to have these early voting hours. I mean, it's just a shocking amount of hubris, a shocking amount of arrogance, and us sitting and complaining isn't doing anything about it. You know, the one thing I really enjoyed in looking historically at some of the presidential, you know, races of the last several years, I loved it when Lyndon Johnson said to Martin Luther King, he says, I couldn't agree with you more that things need to change, and you have to make me as president of the United States. As a movement, people have got to become organized. They can't be worried about the latest iPhone, the latest iPad, the latest gadget, the latest whatever. They've got to take a look at what the hell is actually happening around them and mobilize in a way that's much more effective than Occupy. Occupy opened the door, but then allowed themselves, because they refused to work within the process to change the process, they became, you know, basically powerless to do anything. And protest is good, but you have to mobilize, you have to protest, and you have to have a course of action to force change. You can't just sit outside, bang drums, make peace, love, not war. You've really got to be in a position now to change the system from within, demand change, or force people out of office. And we're not seeing enough done in that area.
You know, to me, the issue that this story raises and becomes this: if the process whereby American citizens elect their leadership, if that process is tainted, is damaged, is tampered with, is destroyed, is manipulated, is in fact completely the product of a cabal, there's no other word for it. It's not an election. It's a coup. And I know that's a hard thing to say, and it's a harder thing for a lot of people to hear, but that is what the evidence seems to be pointing to.
It's a non-military coup. I mean, we've seen a judicial coup in Egypt. We've seen, you know, it's true. I mean, you know, corporations are not people, my friend. And, you know, and if we think that, then we're much further down the path towards our own destruction or revolution, because it doesn't seem to be this. You know, we've ignored climate change, and you've seen what that's done in New York over the last week, and it's just insane. And we cannot continue in such a horrific fashion to kill ourselves and everything around us.
You know, I would say right now that the only thing this country has going for it, and again, this is, you know, going to sound ironic, but I think Sandy is the best possible thing that could have happened to wake up America, that this whole concept that we can do without the government working together to do things for citizens, it turns it on its head. How can Mitt Romney says we don't need FEMA, we can do this, I built it. Who's going to be rebuilding the subway system? Who's going to be rebuilding the factories? Who's going to be rebuilding? Who's cleaning up the? It's so ludicrous that it's almost funny if it wasn't so damn serious.
I saw a story about the Army Corps of Engineers unwatering team. That's what they actually call them, and they were literally saying that once the equipment is placed, it's a matter of hours to drain a tunnel, and that blew me away to think that that much water, when you can see ground level to ground level, then going underneath, could be drained. And as a matter of fact, the Amtrak tunnel to Newark is already open, and they started running trains today on it. That is phenomenal. What private company is going to have the resources in 24 hours to mobilize that team, get them on site, and produce that result? I predict that by the end of the weekend, you could have several lines of the subway working. You could have things dry enough that power could start to come back to lower Manhattan, because they pre-positioned things. Yet heck of a job Brownie was saying, why did the president move so quickly? I'm like, what a moron. What an idiot. If you've got, they were predicting an 11-foot storm surge at the highest tide. They had a 14-foot storm surge. Unprecedented. And at 11.5, that was higher than anything they had ever seen. Yet you've got teams on the ground mobilized. Yeah, okay, people are being inconvenienced. There's no power. There's no lights. There's no gas. You know what? You're alive. And not only that, you've got people working for you that if you had a Romney administration looking at, getting rid of FEMA and privatizing all of this, they would still have their thumbs so far up their assholes, they wouldn't know what they were doing.
Well, Halliburton would be delivering tainted water using slave labor, and there'd be military XE or Blackwater all over the streets of Manhattan.
Yeah, shooting Americans.
Right, there you go. Peace, justice, the American way. back to this tampering. Obviously, there's going to be a follow-up study. Obviously, among those who want to know what's going on, this election, so-called, coming up, is going to be scrutinized. And clearly, the hubris that we've seen on the Republican side, they're just going to go ahead with what they're going to do.
They are, and what you have to count on, sadly, is that enough people have seen enough now over the last week and a half of Romney and his ridiculousness. I mean, Obama won by 9 million votes. He probably actually won by more like 15 million or 20 million. He was so far outside the margin of what would look normal in terms of tampering that he won anyways. And I think he's going to win a lot of the states that are out there. That are the swing states. I mean, I predicted back in December of last year a landslide. I think because there's so many things that go unreported in these polls and the false narratives now of, we've got a chance in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan are just that, completely false. There's enough people that are fed up, both Democrat and Republican. I mean, when you have Bloomberg come out in support of Obama, when you see what you've seen the last 48, 72 hours in terms of cooperation between Democrats and Republicans, people want that. Yes, you know what? You attack each other when times are good, and you go after each other's philosophies, but the deeply personal attacks and what I call ODS, this racist Obama derangement syndrome that is driving the Deep South and driving mostly white, mostly males across the United States, is a cancer in the country. And it is something that just needs to be exercised. And thankfully, demographics is doing that. You're seeing a growth in Latin American voters who are turning around and saying, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. You're seeing a growth in Chinese voters. You're seeing a growth in African American voters. And there is absolutely nothing that these people can do short of going out and gunning people down to stop the tide that is about to overcome them.
Well, I think it's a dark day for the Republican Party when their big hope is that no one catches them on the latest lie.
Yeah. And you know what? People do. And you know, I find it extremely interesting that yesterday, the 1st of November, you had former President Bill Clinton out on the campaign trail for Barack Obama conducting four events to the point where he was hoarse at the end of the day, and former President George W. Bush at an investment seminar in the Cayman Islands giving a keynote address. All right? That alone shows the difference between the two parties. One clearly cares about firing up their base and supporters. The other clearly cares about pulling the wool over people's eyes. And frankly, any blue-collar, working-class American that votes Republican has drunk the Kool-Aid and needs to take it to the next step and just pull the trigger, because they're clearly not voting with clear eyes, strong hearts, or anything like that.
Well, you know, the term of art nowadays is low-information voters, people who are not paying attention.
I just had I just got an email from somebody, Babington Johnston, who says, "We are urgently trying to reach Michael Donahoe to contract with him to monitor the voting in Ohio in real time, to apply his formula to detect if there are any discrepancies suggesting voter machine manipulation. Please advise times of the essence, phone number, name, etc." So,
excellent.
People are seeing things. I'm forwarding this to Michael now because it just came in.
Sure.
This is what we're dealing with. And, you know, I can't do anything more than what I'm doing from overseas, but I feel like it's making a difference, if you know what I mean.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I talk to a lot of well-informed progressives. I try to maintain contact with a lot of plain just folks, and I try to listen more than I talk. And it amazes me to no end the two different worlds that the politically alert live in from the folks who are just living their lives. And, you know, we can see this struggle for control of the government in a way that so many people are just completely unaware of.
Yeah. And,
you know, I heard one of my students was talking yesterday saying, "Wow, you know, it's going to be a real pain to vote because they have put so many long-winded, convoluted amendments. We have 11 amendments to vote on, and of course they've shrunk in the voting time, so it's going to be more and more difficult for more people to vote." And all of this is of a piece. It's part of the whole limitation of voting, limitation of access, the onerous guidelines, the paper trail, the photo ID stuff, and I just wonder how much is it going to have to be until a large enough group of people say, this has to stop. This is treason. This is a coup.
And speaking of the fact that this has to stop, well, ladies and gentlemen, we're just about out of time. And I do want to mention, once again, our colleagues, Gwen Holden-Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show, Progress Toward Democracy, Susan Nylon with her Nylon Report, and Anita Stewart with her Wise Women Media. So make sure you take a listen to those shows. Also, you probably want to listen to the Dave Pakman show to hear more from our friend Dennis Campbell from the UK Progressive. I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you tonight. And next week we're going to have a fine group of progressive activists who will be reviewing the election results. So tune in. You'll hear some thoughtful responses, some good anecdotes, and, of course, the good news that there's a better world coming. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, and on behalf of myself and my co-producer, Mickey Royce, we want to thank you for joining us. Remember, we're building a better world. Talk to you next week. Thank you. also want to thank our sponsors, Imagineering Productions, a full-service multimedia and web SEO marketing, and also the good people, the media goddess, for all your public relations